Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia that killed 7 people and injured 200, and look into why, within a day of the tragedy, the Republican House voted to slash Amtrak's funding by $251 million from its previous paltry funding of $1.14 billion, less than half of the $2.45 billion President Obama had requested. Andy Koontz, the president and CEO of the U.S. High Speed Rail Association, joins us to discuss the reasons why America is the only developed country without a modern rail system that is now being further starved of funds, while China is spending $128 billion a year on its nationwide high speed rail system. Then we will speak with Jesselyn Raddick, the head of the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Project, about the sentencing of CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling for leaking classified information to the New York Times' James Risen. We'll discuss the glaring double standard of jailing Sterling for revealing information about Operation Merlin, a botched attempt to disrupt Iran's nuclear program, while allowing former CIA Chief General Petraeus to plead to a misdemeanor for giving highly classified information to his biographer and lover. Then finally, we will examine what is behind the privatization of education in the name of reform that is turning America's students into profit centers to be saddled with a lifetime of debt for education without knowledge. The author of the new book, 16 for 16, A Progressive Agenda for a Better America, Salvatore Bobones, joins us. He is a professor of sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we will discuss his article at Salon, Education Reform's Big Lie, The Real Reasons the Right Has Declared War on Our Public Schools. And joining us now is Andy Koontz, who is the president and CEO of the U.S. High Speed Rail Association and a national award-winning designer with a background in community design, urban planning, and sustainability. As an authority on high-speed rail, he's committed to further development of the United States High-Speed Rail Association and the high-speed rail network in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Koontz.
Thank you for having me.
And just literally within a day of an Amtrak train being derailed in Philadelphia on Tuesday night, killing 7 people and injuring as many as 200, the Congress cut funds for Amtrak. So that seems extraordinary. What's your reaction to that?
That is pretty extraordinary. In some respects, it's sad to see, because what we really should be doing is investing much more money into rail. That, you know, it is an old system. It literally is 100 years old. We've invested almost nothing in it, and, you know, things start falling apart and having problems when that is the case.
So apparently President Obama had requested $2.45 billion for Amtrak, and the Republican-led House Appropriations Committee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Appropriations Bill, they cut Amtrak's funding from $1.14 billion, which is, you know, less than half of what Obama asked for, down $251 million from its current level. So how do you explain this disconnect between an aging infrastructure that needs investment and cutting what little investment there is? What's driving that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, on the surface, it makes no sense, and especially with given the trends that have been happening, that driving has actually been on the decline for a decade, and rail ridership has been on the increase for a decade, even with our aging system. But if you peel away the surface of all this, you find that our congressional leaders have had an enormous bias towards certain forms of transportation while having a bias against others. For example, you know, for the last 75 years, we've been spending all of our money, trillions of dollars, building a state-of-the-art highway system and a state-of-the-art airport and aviation system, while during those same years, we've literally starved our rail network year after year after year. So it's clearly a major bias. And really, if you peel back even a little further, you find that all the largest American corporations are in those industries and using their influence to keep everything steered in the direction of, you know, what was the 1950s, when now so many things are changing. We need to be looking towards the 21st century, and many of our systems, but mainly transportation, is highly problematic, and we do need to be making, you know, paradigm shifts in transportation.
Well, just to give you a comparison, how in terms of the investment here in the United States in rail, particularly in high-speed rail, we just pointed out that the funding for Amtrak for the next 4 years is at a rate of $1.4 billion, and they've just cut that by $251 million, and that just happened literally today, you know, less than a day after this terrible accident. The Chinese government is spending $128 billion on high-speed rail. And we know, of course, that other countries like France and throughout Europe, they have high-speed rail, and particularly in Japan, where they have the famous bullet train. And the best we have is the Acela, and it has to slow down every, 100 miles or so.
Well, you know, there's no question about it. China, what they're doing right now is what we should be doing. They set up a stimulus plan, and they put something like $400 billion into high-speed rail to completely, almost overnight, modernize their entire national transportation network. It was an unbelievable feat, and, you know, an amazing focused project that, you know, as a nation as big as China, that was amazing and miraculous, and it's going to set them up for success for the next 100 years. It's exactly what we should be doing. That's the kind of transportation and the kind of investment. We need to be investing hundreds of billions of dollars into a state-of-the-art rail system and build like what China has. They now have a super efficient, super high capacity, super fast transportation system for all their people can move around the whole country very quickly and efficiently. You're not delayed anywhere along the line. You don't have the kind of hassles, layers and layers of hassles that we have to go through in this country, stuck in traffic, stuck in airports, stuck in hotels by the airport because, you know, your next flight is in the morning and those kind of issues. Whereas when you have a national high-speed rail system, your entire economy flourishes.
So is there an explanation in terms of this counterintuitive situation where you have a disastrous train accident which kills 7 people? And by the way, this is a train corridor that a lot of Congress people use, as far as I know.
I even heard there was a congressman on the train.
Well, the next day they cut.
I don't know if he was injured or not injured, but he was okay. But I think he was on the train.
Well, within a day they cut the funding. So is this to do with this obsession about anything that the government does is wrong, that Amtrak being a government funded is therefore a part of the problem?
That's some of the rhetoric that you hear mainly coming from Republicans. But yet there's so many other areas where they're fully funding government things. Like they're still funding major road projects, which is government. You know, defense projects, it's all government, you know, on and on and on. So that's some rhetoric that bounces around, but, you know, that doesn't really justify it because it's not the same in other areas. What really is shocking is that, you know, this is the kind of transportation investments we need to be making for all of America to be successful. Is what, you know, big corporations need this so that they can be more efficient and move their people and their goods around America much more quickly and efficiently, and then compete with international companies in the same industries. So this is something that really affects the whole nation, from the biggest corporations down to people who are commuting to a job that they now have more access to because of a better train system. You know, if you think about that, there's a lot of people that can't afford a car, and there's not enough jobs that are within their realm of being able to get to in a reasonable time frame, whereas high-speed rail can open up even that whole market for, you know, much greater job opportunities. You can get discount tickets and student tickets, and you know, where firms can then have a larger reach to better pool of workers. So there's so many areas where this would open up countless, you know, domino effects of benefits.
Well, the only example I think that we have of a high-speed train network that's at least being proposed, and of course it's being challenged right, left, and center, and that is the 220 mile per hour Los Angeles to San Francisco train under the California High-Speed Rail Authority, which is a public entity and separate from Amtrak. That's being attacked all of the time. The Obama administration has granted $3.3 billion, but the actual rail cost would be, what, over $10 billion at least.
Well, the full build-out, I thought we mentioned that. That's definitely the exemplary system right now in the United States, but that's not being led by the private sector. That's being led by the state of California, public.
I understand, and it's being ridiculed and attacked.
And some of it's the same people who are, you know, working with Congress to get them to block funding. I mean, it's kind of a lot of the ridicule and all the naysayers, a lot of it's coming from the same places, from think tanks that, you know, sort of are related to the old era of transportation. Big roads, big oil, you know, that kind of thing.
So what happened then to the U.S. rail system? Yeah, from the halcyon days, I don't know, you know, remember that movie by Hitchcock, North by Northwest, is the classic train sequence in that. So there was that sense of, in the 50s, that the golden age of rail, what happened? They just simply stopped funding it?
Well, yeah, exactly. And then some of the companies actually conspired and started ripping some of it out. We actually had, in addition to, this is actually pretty amazing, in addition to the longer distance trains, they were really luxuries. Even very wealthy people had their own private cars, and they looked like somebody's living room inside with beautiful lounge chairs and lamps, and, you know, they had cigar cars and bars and everything on the trains. That's actually how people traveled. And at the same time, all of our cities across America had very extensive streetcar systems. Literally, you can look up some of the old maps. Many of the cities had them on every street or every other street. So wherever you lived, you'd walk one block or you just walk out your door and the streetcars were coming by every couple minutes. And you just hop on one. They looked like the current ones, the San Francisco cable cars that are running still in San Francisco. Those were all over the entire country. So we had that's how America began. And that was well up into the late 1930s. And then several companies actually conspired at that point and helped tear out a lot of our rail systems. You can look the case up, National City Lines.
Right. Well, here in Los Angeles,
all the way to the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, here in Los Angeles, the red car was deliberately destroyed by a consortium of, I think, a petroleum company.
Same consortium I'm talking about. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they did it nationwide. They did it in like 80 cities simultaneously. That's what's really amazing. So all of a sudden, overnight, a country this big went from a rail culture quickly into a car culture. You know, and by the time everyone woke up, we were a car culture with freeways being built everywhere.
So how do we get back to a rail culture, particularly when you have accidents like this accident that just took place in Philadelphia, where obviously it doesn't help advocate for rail? And we also know that the Congress just cut funds to starve Amtrak even further, and it's been gradually starved over the years to the point where it's falling apart and accidents like this are bound to happen. So how do you reverse this?
Well, you could look at that either way. Oh, look at the falling apart rail system. It's dangerous. Let's cut all funding and get rid of it. That's how some people like to see. Or you look at the other way and say, oh my God, it needs help. Let's start focusing on it. What the interesting thing is that our car system and our aviation system have both really hit up against the wall in terms of two things. In terms of capacity, literally there just isn't enough runways and isn't enough room to fit all the planes that want to fly. That's why you end up sitting in these traffic jams sometimes on the runway. I've sat on some of those with 15 planes in a row, and you just inch along and inch along like you're sitting at a red light in the middle of a city. And then you look at the tip, like Los Angeles and California is the best example. You look at the freeways there, you can't barely squeeze another car on them. it's already almost paralysis, and you know, it ends up being half the day you're moving along in bump, you know, 18 lanes of bumper to bumper traffic, going barely anywhere. So the and our population's still growing. So the real problem is it's absolutely impossible to actually squeeze more people into the car system or the aviation system, and then to try to actually expand either one of them is another impossibility in terms of sheer costs. And where would you even put another freeway in Los Angeles? Like, if you they said that's actually how California arrived at the high-speed rail idea, was they said, well, you know, we're going to grow 30 million people, and we need to be able to accommodate them and move them around, and we can barely move around and accommodate the people we have now. So what would we need to do to accommodate that many more people? And they said, oh, we'd have to double the California's interstate system. If you could just imagine that, trying to squeeze another 12 or 18-lane freeway through a city. I mean, how would you even remotely do that? And then they said when they looked at the cost, it was going to be hundreds of billions of dollars. And the same with they would have needed seven more airports or something. So they just realized that high-speed rail is actually the easy, cheaper solution, and it has a very tiny little footprint compared to an interstate. Think about how wide a 10 or 12 or 18-lane interstate is. It's hundreds of feet wide, whereas a rail line, a high-speed rail line, is only both lines can fit in less than 100 feet.
Well, Andy, we have to wrap up now, but I just want to add that this lack of investment in infrastructure is across the board, and obviously you've made a good case that the smartest way to spend our dollars would be on high-speed rail. And the point I want to make is that we are still at a time when the price of borrowing money is at an all-time low. You know, the interest rates are down near zero, so historic opportunity is clearly being missed here.
Absolutely. And the problem is, like I said, we have too many members of Congress who are still stuck in the 1950s, that, you know, big oil, big cars, and big roads. And that's what really where the change needs to take place, because they are the ones who appropriate the money year after year, and that dictates what gets built and what we get to use as a nation. So, but I think that the changes are coming because there's no other possible way to continue going the direction we're going. We're hitting walls at every turn. And then the same thing when there's accidents and things like that. You realize that this thing needs some serious investment, and let's really increase the capacity, because this is where we need to be going.
Well, Andy Kuntz, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Andy Kuntz, who's the president and CEO of the U.S. High Speed Rail Association and a national award-winning designer with a background in community design, urban planning, and sustainability. As an authority on high-speed rail, he is committed to further developing the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association and the high-speed rail network in America. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the double standard of jailing a CIA officer while the former head of the CIA, General Petraeus, pled guilty to a misdemeanor for giving highly classified information to his biographer and lover. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jesslyn Radak, who is the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Director, where she works with national security and intelligence community whistleblowers, including those from the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security, NSA, and CIA. She recently represented former NSA official Thomas Drake in the government's unsuccessful prosecution of him under the Espionage Act, and represented former CIA officer John Kiriakou. a former legal ethics advisor to the Department of Justice. She's the author of Traitor, The Whistleblower and the American Taliban. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeshelyn Radak.
Thank you for having me.
And there was a bit of a surprise in the sentencing of Jeffrey Sterling, who's accused of leaking information to the New York Times reporter James Risen, in as much as it doesn't look like the judge who had done earlier cases like Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 13th hijacker, she only gave him 3.5 years when the government asked, what, for a couple of decades, did they not? 20 years.
Yes. Jeffrey Sterling was accused of revealing a botched CIA nuclear program, which he denies doing. And he was convicted of that leak, despite denying it. And the government asked for 20 to 25 year sentence. And that's been the case in all of these Espionage Act prosecutions of people who are whistleblowers. The government seeks decades to the rest of their life in prison. But consistent with people like John Kiriakou, who got 2.5 years, and Stephen Kim, who got 1 year, and Tom Drake, against whom all charges were dropped, she ended up going with 3.5 years, which is still way too long. I mean, the reason I say it's way too long, even though it's so much less than what the government sought, is because any jail time for Jeffrey Sterling is inappropriate in light of what happened in the David Petraeus case. Because in that case, he gave a much greater volume of information, including war codes, undercover identities of three people, and notes up from the President of the United States to his mistress for a biography. And he was allowed to get a sweetheart plea deal that involved no jail time and a fine that was a modest fine that for him is very easy to pay. So in light of what happened with General Petraeus, it really lays bare the fact that this war on whistleblowers, you know, if you're powerful or politically well-connected, you don't have to worry about leaking. But if you leak information that embarrasses the government or, worse, shows its illegalities, you face going to jail or living in exile.
Well, the so-called black books that that General Petraeus had, where he took notes on all these meetings, particularly with the commander-in-chief, the President of the United States, I imagine that the information in those notes of those meetings that they took, that has to be the highest classified secrets in the land, don't they?
Of course, absolutely. That is classified at the highest level. And it wasn't just one single disclosure. Like you mentioned, it is a number of notebooks filled with disclosures, that are only including meetings with the National Security Council, war plans, meetings with the President of the United States. I mean, all sorts of the most tippy-top information that you could possibly disclose to someone not authorized to receive it.
So in terms of what the judge did sentence Jeffrey Sterling for, she more or less indicated that she said that the CIA's case against him was overwrought hyperbole. But she did feel that he had disclosed the identity of an asset or an agent or an informant and put his life at risk. What's your understanding of that charge?
You know, that's interesting that she was so hung up on that, because Jeffrey Sterling was not accused under the Intelligence Identity Protection Act, which is a charge that would be brought for revealing an undercover identity. And moreover, to the extent the judge was hung up on the fact that he may have put at risk someone undercover, that's exactly what the past two former directors of the CIA are guilty of doing, and they didn't get charged at all under anything. Petraeus gave the undercover identities of three different people to Paula Broadwell. And Leon Panetta gave the undercover identity of a U.S. Navy SEAL involved in the Osama bin Laden raid. And neither of them were charged, and they both have lucrative careers. And, you know, they faced no jail time.
Well, so, none of the torturers have been sentenced, including the CIA officer who destroyed 92 videotapes of torture. I mean, the double standards are pretty flagrant here. What explains that to you, as somebody who defends whistleblowers? What is that? How do they get away with that double standard? If the president of the United States is trying to teach a lesson here and tell everybody in the intelligence community to behave themselves, this is the same government, by the way, that leaks stuff from the top every day to reporters.
Yes.
So I'm not sure where the moral line is here.
Well, it's complete hypocrisy, obviously, because as you point out, the biggest leaker in the United States is the U.S. government, and you can read classified information on the pages of the newspaper every day. And he is saying, basically, the president is sending a message that if you are a low-level agency employee who's trying to reveal, fraud, waste, abuse, or illegality of some of our nation's most contentious dark programs, including secret surveillance, torture, war crimes, you will be hammered. Your life will be ruined. And that's an awful message for a president who campaigned on a platform of openness and transparency. He's been the worst president since Nixon when it comes to government secrecy.
And again, I'm speaking with Jesselyn Radack, who's the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Director, where she works with national security and intelligence community whistleblowers, including those from the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security, NSA, and CIA. She represented former NSA official Thomas Drake in the government's unsuccessful prosecution of him under the Espionage Act, and represented former CIA officer John Kiriakou, a former legal ethic.
Yeah.
Go ahead. What are you saying?
I would also say, in representing Edward Snowden, I'm pretty sure he would be glad to have the kind of deal that Petraeus received.
Are you representing Edward Snowden?
Yes.
Oh, you are? I see.
Yeah.
And are you trying to work on a deal to get him to come back to the U.S.?
Well, that would be ideal. He would love to come back, but there's no movement in that direction right now.
I see.
From the government side.
So then just back to the Sterling case, what do we know about the heart of this case, which is that James Risen, and it's worth noting that Condoleezza Rice, the then National Security Advisor, went to the New York Times and tried to get them to basically, I don't know whether she tried to get them to fire him, but to certainly silence this reporter. And he had originally, the paper was given this original story, and they didn't, and Condoleezza Rice successfully got them not to print it. So he put it in his book, and that's pretty much what it is. And the story is basically about Operation Merlin.
Yes, exactly. And this was twice that happened to Jim Risen, where the New York Times refused to publish a story that the government felt was made it look bad or was too controversial. It happened with warrantless wiretapping, and it happened with this program, Operation Merlin, in which we gave flawed nuclear design information to Iran, but they detected the roof. And in the process, we accidentally gave them actionable nuclear intelligence. So it was a big mess up. It's universally seen as a big mess up, yet the agency continues to state what a wonderful program this was. But they're embarrassed. And for embarrassing the agency, you can go to jail.
But you don't go to jail for giving the Iranians real nuclear secrets along with a bunch of bogus ones.
No, and no one got in trouble for that. No one got in trouble. In fact, not only can you destroy torture videotapes, you can write a book about it and be on a book tour right now rather than in a prison cell.
So,
as is the case with Jose Rodriguez.
Right. So in terms of what the judge went down on Jeffrey Sterling about, in terms of even though, as you pointed out earlier, it wasn't a part of the charges that he put jeopardized the safety of an informant, was the informant this former Russian scientist that the CIA used to peddle this stuff to the Iranians?
Yes, it was this guy codenamed Mr. Merlin. Mm. And the strange thing about that is Mr. Merlin was given the opportunity to present a victim impact statement of how he had been hurt by supposedly being outed by the conduct of Jeffrey Sterling, and he refused to do so.
And still, they convicted him.
Yes. Yeah. So he was convicted. It was a circumstantial case. There was no direct evidence. However, he was being tried in the most conservative court in the United States of America, the Eastern District of Virginia.
Well, that, of course, is the favorite court circuit, isn't it, for the Espionage Act, which, by the way, goes back to 1917, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a 100-year-old law. Yes.
So who was his defense then? Sterling's defense? It wasn't you, was it?
His defense was that he didn't do this. His defense lawyers were Mr. McMahon and Barry Pollack, and they did a great job. But his defense was, I did not do this, and you don't have any direct evidence connecting me to New York Times reporter Jim Risen. But in the meantime, the government didn't hesitate to litigate the Risen issue about whether or not he should have to testify against his source all the way up to the Supreme Court, creating very bad precedent for any kind of reporter source privilege. So I think this was a case where they were trying to go after a reporter, and Jeffrey Sterling ended up being the collateral damage.
So in other words, they put all this effort into squeezing James Risen, and he had to fight them all the way to the Supreme Court. And they kept saying, you know, if you just give us our sources, give us your source, and we'll leave you alone. He never gave up his source. But then they decided to try this guy based upon the idea that they thought he was the source. I mean, what was that?
Yeah, they said they eventually decided they would go ahead and try to go to trial without Risen's testimony, and they'd still be able to get a conviction, and they were right. They did. So they had been going after Jeffrey Sterling all along, but they also, it was kind of a twofer. They could get both Sterling and Risen, both of whom the government hated, using this draconian lawsuit that dragged on for years and years and years.
And Sterling's an African American, is he not?
He is. Yes. And there are no African Americans on the jury.
And how many in the CIA, do you know?
Not many at all. He had filed a race discrimination complaint earlier that the agency said it couldn't resolve because it would reveal state secrets. Apparently, Sterling famously said, "How long after sending me to Iraq did it take you to realize that I'm black?"
So he wasn't one of their favorites to begin with. You think he was a sacrificial lamb? Or, I mean, the case that they made to link him to Risen, was it credible?
He's one of some 20 people who had access to the kind of information that ended up in Risen's book.
I see.
But there were numerous people who testified that they didn't think he was the source, that they thought the Senate Intelligence Committee was the source for Risen's book. So they've been gunning for him, I think, for a long time. And he and the agency parted company, on a bad note. And this was a way for them to exact their pound of flesh. Similar to what they did to Kiriakou. They didn't like him either, and they made it personal. If you read the sentencing memorandum, it is very personal. It's not the way you normally would talk about some random defendant. it just attacked him personally as a man and his credibility and his motives, and it was vitriolic.
Well, Justin Raddick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Raddick, who is the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Director, where she works with national security and intelligence community whistleblowers, including those from the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security, NSA, and CIA. She recently represented former NSA official Thomas Drake in the government's unsuccessful prosecution of him under the Espionage Act, and represented former CIA officer John Kiriakou. A former legal ethics advisor to the Department of Justice, she's the author of Traitor, The Whistleblower, and The American Taliban. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into what is behind the privatization of education in the name of reform.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI.
Goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Salvatore Bobonis, who is a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. His latest book just out is 16 for 16, A Progressive Agenda for a Better America. And he has an article at Salon.com, Education Reform's Big Lie, The Real Reason the Right Has Declared War on Our Public Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Salvatore Bobonis.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on the program.
So both titles of your book and of the article raise questions. Let's start with your new book. What do you mean by 16 for 16?
These are simply 16 no-nonsense reforms that we should have in America to make a progressive agenda for the 2016 election. 16 for 16 is simply a play on the year of the election, but I think 16 is about the right number for a coherent policy platform for a progressive agenda.
And then the other question which you raise, the real reason the right has declared war on our public schools. That, of course, is not necessarily a one-sentence answer, but please go ahead.
Well, the Salon created the title for that article. The title of the chapter in my book is actually very much simpler, A Rededication to Public Education. What we need in America is a public school system. And the chapter three of the book, is about the risk we have of transferring our public patrimony of the public school system into private gain. That's what Salon picked up on, is the threat that corporations pose to the future of our public schools.
Well, we already don't have public squares. So we have mega churches and malls, and public schools are under attack. And my sense is that it's more than about education. And in fact, you make this point, it's really about America as a nation. If we are continuing on this path of balkanization, particularly in terms of education and information, where Christians get their information from Christian broadcasting, liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, and so on, the only place in America where people get together and act as a whole and belong to a community known as the United States of America are in public schools, because once you leave school, you know, the process of balkanization seems to begin.
Right.
So to me, this is very critical.
Well, schools really are the foundation of our communities. If you think about it, We don't feed each other's children. We don't house each other's children. We don't clothe each other's children. The one thing we do together is raise our children in public schools. And that doesn't just bring our children together into a community. That brings us together in communities. I mean, I think that one of the rock-solid foundations of America is the fact that education historically has always been local. Local communities support their schools, not some faraway governments. Taxes and funding may come from federal and state governments, but control has always been in the hands of local school boards. Hiring private companies to handle education effectively puts control of our schools in faraway boardrooms, which is even worse than having it in federal and state government legislatures.
Well, I've done a lot of coverage on the for-profit college racket in this country, which is absolutely unconscionable because they depend almost entirely on federal funds. And
right. Well, as a college teacher, don't get me started on for-profit colleges.
Well, but I'm just saying that's the most egregious example where you basically have, and essentially what it is a debt trap. It's a Wall Street operation to get people into debt, just like payday lenders are a debt trap. But it is enabled by the federal government. About $30 to $40 billion of taxpayer money goes to this racket, and for reasons that should mystify me, Arne Duncan, President Obama's good friend, doesn't seem to be able to do anything about it. So, you know, the idea of the kind of reform you're talking about is pretty radical, and it would require a kind of revolutionary fervor, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think it's radical. I actually think it's conservative. And this is really my motivation for writing the entire book, 16 for 16, is that progressive agendas in America today really are conservative agendas. I mean, what could be more conservative than saying that America's public schools should be controlled by America's communities? I don't think there's anything more conservative than that in any political debate in our country. So I don't see it as a radical agenda. I see it as the right agenda, you know, the correct agenda, the agenda we should all embrace. I can't imagine conservative parents wanting their children to be educated by for-profit companies. Now, I can imagine them wanting other people's children to be educated by for-profit companies, but I can't imagine them wanting their own children educated that way.
And again, I'm speaking with Salvador Bobonis, who's a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. His latest book just out is 16 for 16, A Progressive Agenda for a Better America. And he has an article at Salon.com, Education Reform's Big Lie, The Real Reason the Right Has Declared War on Our Public Schools. Well, what I meant by radical means it would require a radical effort. It would require people to really take on the system. And when you think, and as you point out in your book, that this whole road to ruin in the name of reform began with the 1983 report, A Nation at Risk, subtitled The Imperatives of Education Reform, which was put together by President Reagan's first Secretary of Education, Terrell Bell. And he appointed this 18-person commission, and this is the genesis of this whole privatization movement, goes back to then. But when you list who was on the commission, it's pretty shocking. Of the 18 people, there were 12 administrators, one business person, one chemist, one physicist, one politician, one conservative activist, and one teacher. No students,
exactly,
or parents or any other stakeholders. And that seems to be that what characterizes this movement, but yet it's got all kinds of friendly faces and earnest people to join in this bogus idea of education reform, whether it's charter schools or whatever it is. That's what I find extraordinary, is how many concerned parents have bought into it.
I think it's amazing. One thing I think is amazing is the linguistic change. The Nation at Risk report changed reform into a verb that meant to make something worse. Reform used to mean to make things better. But I think, you know, linguistics are really at the heart of this. The real radicals are the people who want to privatize schools. I believe with all my heart that the conservative agenda is the progressive agenda, that having our children educated by unionized teachers in our local schools, embedded in communities, is not a radical idea. That's the conservative idea. The radical idea is to privatize schools, hire a company to teach your children, and to pay them profit based on children's test scores. I mean, that's an extraordinarily radical solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
So how did we get an education system? It seems like it's been corrupted from within and made easy pickings. I mean, for example, I'll give you an example of the assault and destruction of the U.S. Postal Service, which is a venerable institution. Mm-hmm. The Congress deliberately are bankrupting it because they made them prepay 75 years of pensions, which they simply can't do, and they're going bankrupt. So it seems to be that some of these tactics are being used. But in this case, the idea that over the years there's been this growth of school administrators at the expense of the growth of good educators. So what's been driving that? This is even before you get to the privatization agenda.
Right. The growth in school administrators is not something that I want to vilify. It's an easy target. Administrators are evil and teachers and students are good, but I'm sure that 99% of school administrators are dedicated professionals trying to do a good job for our kids. Administration grows because the system changes over time. We want greater professionalization. We want oversight. We want reports done. We want grant proposals done. I have no problem with the growth in administration. I do have a problem with the growth of administrative salaries. That is, I have seen no reason why a school administrator should be a CEO making CEO pay when an administrator in any other government department is merely, in the good sense of the word, a bureaucrat. I think that money is corrupting our school administrative systems. I'm not as much worried about the number of administrators as I am worried about the amount we're paying them. And we're attracting people into administration who simply want to make money instead of people who are dedicated to the job.
So in terms of this, the vilification that you mentioned, what has driven, and it's certainly taken hold, the vilification of teachers' unions?
Oh, teachers' unions are a barrier to the program that the right has to corporatize America. Teachers' unions are in the crosshairs the same way all unions are in the crosshairs. Teachers' unions, of course, exist to ensure secure pay and working conditions for teachers, but they do much more than that. I mean, all unions are concerned with pay and conditions. Teachers' unions go one step further. Teachers' unions are about maintaining the professional integrity of the discipline. So we don't want teachers to come under pressure to just pass students. We don't want teachers to come under pressure to teach to the test. We don't want teachers to come under pressure to accept bribes if we were to look out into the future. To prevent these sorts of pressures, we unionize teachers and give them security. I mean, many people in America admire Chinese school systems, and in particular, the Shanghai school system has outperformed American schools on international tests. But the Shanghai school system is riddled with bribery. If you want your child to get a high grade, you pay the teacher for extra after-hours, quote-unquote, tutoring. And then if the teacher's pay depends on your student doing well, tutoring, then, of course, that teacher is much more likely to give your student a good grade. We don't want that kind of corrupt system in America where teachers are working in order to get their students the grades that their parents are willing to pay for. We want a system in America where teachers are objective, fair, treat everybody the same way. And the way you get that is through the protections that a union provides.
Well, when you talk about 16 for 16, meaning 2016, the election year, there's a chance that Scott Walker, who's somewhat like the front runner at the moment, obviously it's early days on the Republican side. I mean, he's made a career and he's running as president based upon his union busting. So if he becomes president, look out, teachers' unions.
Well, I think that's very scary. I think the prospect of any of the major Republican candidates becoming president is very scary. But it's not just the presidential level. My book, 16 for 16, focuses on presidential level policies because that's what we all pay attention to in an election year. But it's the congressional elections, it's local state elections, it's school board elections, it's every level that matters. I mean, U.S. education is not a purely local, state, or federal issue. It's a true national issue in the sense that every level of government is involved in funding, regulating, and supporting America's school system.
And do you think that the growing anti-intellectualism in public discourse and public life and in the media and in the celebrity world, where you've got the Kardashians, in the political world, Sarah Palin clearly was an icon of anti-intellectualism. You've got people in the Congress and the Senate in charge of committees that oversee the environment. And, you know, they're global warming deniers. So, it's, you know, anti-intellectualism is being in many ways celebrated. And the media, of course, because it always has to be fair and balanced, it equates creationism with evolution and global warming denial with the 97% of scientists who say it's real. So is that a factor in this, you think, in terms of that? Is intellectualism not valued in this country anymore?
To be honest, I'm not so worried about anti-intellectualism. If you remember your history, there used to be a party in 19th century America proudly called the Know-Nothing Party. So anti-intellectualism is nothing new in America. The real threat is deprofessionalization. I'm not suggesting that intellectuals be put in charge of education. I mean, people like me, I'm a professional researcher at a major research university. I shouldn't be in charge of your children's education. The people who should be in charge of your children's education are local school boards, your teachers, even your administrators at your local school, communities working together. I think one of the dangers in education is having so-called intellectuals on the right who have an agenda that they've thought up in a university classroom or a university research center for completely changing the system in their own image. Those intellectuals or pseudo-intellectuals are the real threat. I think good old-fashioned American values, people trusting in their own resources and their own communities to make decisions, can really solve the problems we face in America's schools.
But is there a way, though? I don't mean intellectualism so much as being imposed, but how do you encourage intellectual curiosity in children?
I think everybody does that. I think parents do that very successfully at home. Just sending your child, taking your child to a park or a zoo or a museum, encouraging reading at home. These are things that millions of parents do every day. I mean, how many parents have taken their children to the public library? Well, the problem is not the parents and their anti-intellectualism. The problem is that the government is defunding public libraries.
I see. So in your manifesto, 16 for 16, is there a way that systemically you can somehow engender intellectual curiosity? In my sense of is that a lot of kids are bored. They're on their iPhones. They're more interested in what each other is wearing at school, fashions. I mean, these are the cliches that we're told about.
Right, right.
So,
I'm a social scientist. As a social scientist, I believe very strongly that the way to make a better, more educated, more intellectual society is to put the resources in people's own hands. It's not for me to write a book that teaches people how to become an intellectual. The real way to do it is to empower people. So, for example, in the book, I have a chapter on job creation. People, the sine qua non, the thing everybody needs to have before they can worry about reading and theoretical physics and the future of the English language. The thing people really need to have is a job. So jobs first, infrastructure second, public education third, secure health care fourth. We need to create the system that allows people, that supports people in developing their own dreams and aspirations and in exploring. I sincerely believe that if people have the time and freedom to explore the world, to read, to watch documentaries, to go travel, that they become intellectuals. I don't have to teach them how to be an intellectual. People will teach themselves.
Well, but that's not to say, and I'm sure, you know, the purpose of your writing 16 for 16, A Progressive Agenda for a Better America, is to sort of integrate these ideas into kind of public policy.
Of course.
I mean, one of the greatest moments in American history, I think, was after World War II, when you had millions of GIs coming back from the war, no employment because the country had basically turned over to military armaments, and they needed a transition period, and they came up with the GI Bill that put millions of men and some women into education, which they would normally not have gone. These are working class people, people across the board, suddenly got a university education. And it really, I think, was the engine behind that period that was referred to as the American Dream.
You're absolutely right. And World War II and its aftermath are a perfect example. As terrible as the war was, people who participated in it from the United States gained incredible skills training on the job during the war itself. They traveled. Let's not diminish the fact that millions of American soldiers served in Europe and across Asia, so they saw the world. And then they came back and were given the resources to go to school. And I think that it's no coincidence that this generation came to be known as the greatest generation, because this generation had opportunities that generations before it never did. Now, of course, they made terrible sacrifices. They earned those opportunities. But nonetheless, it was that opportunity to travel, to receive an education, to go back to school when they returned to America, then to find secure jobs. You know, most of that generation, when they finished those university educations that were government supported, found themselves in full-time employment with paid sick days, paid holidays, paid vacation days, secure pension plans, good wages. Of course that generation was able to flourish. And that's what we need for other generations. We don't need a war. What we need is the GI plan that came after the war.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Salvatore Bobonis.
Thank you for having me on the program.
And again, I've been speaking with Salvatore Bobonis, who's a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. His latest book just out is 16 for 16, A Progressive Agenda for a Better America. And he has an article at Salon.com, Education Reform's Big Lie, The Real Reasons the Right Has Declared War on Our Public Schools. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.